This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Berling. Coming up, a nuclear arms race in India and Pakistan could spell environmental disaster. A warmer Atlantic Ocean this summer may mean more algal blooms on the East Coast. Some reflections about the neutrino and the changing universe. Will environmentalists harness gas-guzzling sport utility vehicles? And on the Earth calendar, a major migration is beginning. It's humans into the national parks. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berlich. The recent nuclear tests conducted by India and Pakistan raise questions about their environmental impact. Underground tests such as these can present a problem if contaminated air or dust is vented from the test hole. Zia Mian, originally from Pakistan, is with the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies at Princeton University. He comments on what we know so far.
There are no reported releases of radioactivity from either of the two sets of tests in India or Pakistan. There have been media reports that people living close to the test sites in India and Pakistan have complained of various illnesses, such as nosebleeds and things like that. But since those areas are typically very, very poor and very underdeveloped, it may be that the typical symptoms of unclean drinking water and poor hygiene, etc., are now simply being transferred over to the effects of radioactivity. The nuclear scientists in both countries have been very adamant and very public in their statements that there was no release of radioactivity. But until objective and independent measurements are allowed, this is not a question that can be answered.
Dr. Meehan says to get a true understanding of the impact of underground tests, extensive monitoring of soil and groundwater is necessary. And monitoring, to be credible, needs to be reviewed by the international scientific community. He thinks a comprehensive program cannot happen in either Pakistan or India.
If anything, there is going to be an enormous resistance to precisely that, because one of the ways of gaining an insight into the efficiency of a nuclear test and the yield is to make precisely those measurements as to see how much of the original material was used up and what kinds of products were released. And so one of the ways that most nuclear weapons testing programs have proceeded is to first order use seismic data and shockwave data to get a first handle on the yield of the explosion and its efficiency, and then to follow that up with detailed radiochemical measurements of precisely the kinds of things that I've been mentioning to get a better insight into the dynamics of the explosion itself. So neither country is likely to allow that kind of activity, and if they do it themselves, are unlikely to make it public.
Aside from a nuclear war, experts say the real environmental hazard caused by a nuclear arms race on the Indian subcontinent is from production of fissionable material. Again, Dr. Meehan.
This is actually almost as great a danger in the medium term as the critical and urgent danger of the possibility of crisis leading to war, because India and Pakistan have notoriously unsafe nuclear facilities. The Indian nuclear power program has been plagued with all kinds of safety problems and radiation problems. And Pakistan has, even though it has a much smaller nuclear power program, has also had enormous problems. Now, given that, it's reasonable to presume that their nuclear weapons material production facilities are similarly poorly operated. And so one can expect large numbers of problems. We know that in Pakistan, certainly at the uranium mines that they have, where the uranium is mined both for the nuclear power program and for the nuclear weapons program, there have been deaths of miners. The miners there, in fact, went on strike in 1996 in protest against the poor safety conditions imposed upon them by the Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission.
Scientists familiar with the plutonium processing operations in both countries are pessimistic about what is happening. Arjun Makajani, originally from India and now president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Maryland, sees real problems.
The Indian tests are based on plutonium weapons. Plutonium is made in a reactor and then chemically separated. That chemical separation process is very dirty and results in a lot of liquid radioactive waste, some highly radioactive, and a very large volume of not very radioactive wastes. For instance, in Britain, in the northwest of England, where there's such a plant to separate plutonium, the Irish Sea has become quite contaminated. It's even more contaminated than areas in the Marshall Islands where nuclear weapons testing took place. There is quite a bit of contamination, and reports on India's nuclear program have indicated that workers have suffered quite high levels of radiation doses and so on.
Dr. Meehan is concerned about plutonium production in Pakistan.
Given that Pakistan in particular has set up a new dedicated plutonium production reactor at a town called Khushab, which is on the Indus River, that raises enormous problems that an accident there could contaminate one of the world's great rivers, which is responsible for irrigation and water supply to the entire country. So the possibilities of even a small accident there contaminating such a huge area of basically agricultural and rural country would be a terrible prospect.
In light of the environmental dangers posed by a race to produce nuclear arms by India and Pakistan, it seems clear that efforts to diminish the chance of a nuclear exchange will not be enough to protect the environment. The process of building the bombs themselves poses a major threat to both the environment and human health. And at the moment, there does not seem to be any obvious way to stop the danger. I'm Peter Burley. El Niño is finally dying out. This is good news for many folks who have suffered the negative effects of the warm water phenomenon, and others are just tired of hearing about it. But the experts say its effects may still be felt through the summer, especially along the eastern coastline of the United States. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports.
There is a greater possibility that harmful algae outbreaks will occur along the eastern seaboard. That was the message officials from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, recently gave to a U.S. Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Science and Fisheries. Scientists are specifically concerned with coastal waters along the mid-Atlantic states. In an effort to better prepare states like Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, and North Carolina for such algal blooms, NOAA and the Environmental Protection Agency are providing additional funds so states can increase their monitoring efforts. Dr. Don Scavia is senior scientist for the National Ocean Services Division of NOAA.
Well, in the particular cases of Fisteria, but also more generally in the case of harmful blooms generally, most of the issues, most of the problems actually occur in state waters. And so it's generally the states that have the responsibility for either closing down shellfish beds or closing down beaches and areas that are impacted by the toxic blooms. The most that we can do at this point in time is effectively monitor and assess the conditions so that they can react appropriately and conservatively to protect human health in most cases. We are not in a position to be able to make good forecasts or predictions of where the blooms are going to occur. It would be nice to be able to do that, and in fact we have research programs in place trying to get there. But at this point, the best we can do is monitor and be able to respond when it happens.
Algal blooms are caused by microscopic organisms that, under certain conditions, reproduce at such a rate that they actually cloud the water. These blooms have often been called red or brown tides. Dr. Scavia says there are three main reasons why monitoring for these blooms is important. First is the fish kills and other environmental problems they create. Second is the health risks they pose to humans. And last is the potential financial losses.
Last year during the Fisteria problem in the Chesapeake area, it's been estimated that the shellfish industry in the region lost about $40 million. but the only species impacted was menhaden, which is a species that's not in the seafood market. So there's a halo effect or a shadow effect where people are concerned about purchasing seafood of any kind in the area. So there's an economic impact that's important as well.
Scientists say additional rains brought on by El Nino this past year could spur algal blooms. Nitrogen and phosphorus are picked up by runoff waters and carried to the oceans. This creates what is known as nutrient loading, where increased concentrations of chemicals are washed into the water. Both nitrogen and phosphorus contribute to plant growth, and some scientists believe it's these extra nutrients that are causing more frequent algal blooms. Dr. Scavius says researchers are still trying to solve the puzzle.
But what seems to be happening over the more recent years is when the blooms come to shore, they seem to last longer and become more intense. One of the hypotheses is that extra nutrients leaving the ocean, leaving the land, going into the ocean, are actually stimulating stronger blooms when they come to shore. So some are direct, some are indirect. But then some are probably not very related to the nutrient issue at all.
Some scientists are pointing to animal farm waste as a major contributor to nutrient loading. Research in this area is ongoing. Besides precipitation levels, scientists say warmer air temperatures from El Nino have contributed to warmer water temperatures in the Atlantic. Mike Crowley is director of the Remote Sensing Lab at Rutgers University's Institute of Marine and Coastal Sciences. He and his staff are monitoring ocean temperatures by satellite.
El Nino did keep our weather warmer, our climate warmer over this winter, so kept our air temperatures warmer, and the air temperatures then allowed our ocean temperatures to stay warmer over the January, February, early March times when it usually gets very, very cold and the temperatures fall. They never did this year, so there's been kind of early spring temperatures all through the winter.
Crowley says Atlantic coastal temperatures this spring are about 3 to 6 degrees warmer than normal. He says warmer surface temperatures and algal blooms can deplete oxygen levels, which has led to large fish kills in the past. Dr. Herb Austin is a marine biologist at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science at the College of William and Mary. He says while milder temperatures often induce fish to spawn earlier, it's too early to tell just how fish populations are being affected.
And we have seen better survival this winter of some of the overwintering fish, that, like croaker, that overwinter in the Chesapeake Bay. Some of the species like catfish in the rivers are further downriver because salinities are lower due to the rainfall and runoff. So we see, you know, a displacement of the fish due more, I think, to the change in salinity from the rain. So far, anyhow, than temperature. Where that'll begin to show up will be by midsummer.
In the end, scientists say the warmer waters in the Atlantic could be great for swimming this summer, as long as there are no harmful algal blooms to close the beaches. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Still to come: big cars and small atomic particles. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Your comments are interesting to us and may be interesting to our listeners. Give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. And now a reflection. On Friday, June 5, a headline on the front page of the New York Times proclaimed, "Mass found in elusive particle. Universe may never be the same." The article described research leading scientists to believe that the neutrino, a subatomic particle, has weight. It is theorized that neutrinos could have as much mass as the rest of the universe. Before this weighty discovery, neutrinos were not known to have weight. Imagine that the universe will never be the same, simply because the New York Times has decreed the fact. The night the article was published, I went out to our sheep pasture and looked at the sky. The Big Dipper and the North Star were in the same place. The Milky Way looked much as it had the night before, and the sheep did not seem to notice that the universe had changed either. But of course, they don't read the New York Times. Is it possible that the New York Times was wrong? Could it be that the universe is still the same, but our previous assumptions were in error? In an earlier time, we found the Earth is not the center of the solar system. When will we realize that we are only one small part of the universe around us? That there are huge natural forces out there which we do not comprehend, but which exist despite the limitation of our vision? On the other hand, if the New York Times can forever change the universe with a headline, perhaps it could change some things closer to the planet, like acid rain or ocean pollution. I'm Peter Burley.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, the Roadhog Reduction Campaign, putting an end to the drive of shame. Automakers advertise them as sexy suburban vehicles that can transform your family outing into a wilderness adventure. But according to Friends of the Earth, the likes of Jeep Cherokee, Land Rover, Dodge Durango, and Lincoln Navigator are just big, monstrous roadhogs. These and other sports utility vehicles, explains Galway Kripke, director of economic programs at Friends of the Earth, not only increase the dangers of driving, but waste fuel and are highly polluting.
One of the newest initiatives of Friends of the Earth is our Roadhog Reduction Campaign. It's an offshoot of our concern about global warming or the possibilities of global warming, because the U.S. needs to take some steps to reduce our emissions of greenhouse gas pollutants, namely carbon dioxide. A quarter of the total emissions of greenhouse gases is from personal cars. That's the cars you and I drive. Some cars we're driving are more efficient than they were, but as a whole, the efficiency of the U.S. fleet is not getting any better. And the reason is Americans are starting to drive more and more inefficient cars.
Namely, sports utility vehicles. So to help inform consumers, Kripke says Friends of the Earth, a Washington-based environmental organization, put together the Roadhog Campaign, supplying facts and figures about how sports utility vehicles contribute to the destruction of the environment.
They're much more polluting than average cars, and not just because they're bigger, but because federal standards allow sport utility vehicles to be more polluting. They consume 33% more gasoline than regular passenger cars, and in addition, they're allowed to emit more toxic and noxious chemicals than regular cars are.
Classified as light trucks, Kripke continues, automakers exploit loopholes in federal standards to build sports utility vehicles that net them hefty profits. The CAFE, or Federal Corporate Average Fuel Economy Standards, set the fuel economy goals for automobiles. Kripke says passenger cars are currently allowed 27.5 miles per gallon. Under the law, sports utility vehicles, along with real trucks, only have to achieve 20.7 miles per gallon. So, as Kripke said earlier, roadhogs are allowed to waste 33% more gasoline than passenger cars. Also, he adds, federal law gives the heaviest sport utility vehicles permission to emit higher levels of toxic and noxious pollution, 75% more than cars. And in addition to the environmental damage, Kripke says they're risky to drive.
These are enormous machines, and there's an increasing amount of evidence that they're causing more fatalities on the roads.
Kripke hopes the Road Hogs campaign will get people thinking, because the vehicles we drive today, he says, will greatly influence the safety of our roads and the quality of our environment. Friends of the Earth was founded in 1969 by environmentalist David Browner to help unify the voices of those working for a healthy and livable planet, and is part of an international network including over 60 affiliates. Friends of the Earth is probably best known for their Green Scissors campaign, where they have exposed and ended hidden government pork barrel projects such as poorly planned highways and destructive dams that were not needed. For more information on the Road Hogs campaign, you can visit their website at www.suv.org. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. This is the segment of the Environment Show where we usually look at bird or whale migrations, blooming flowers, crop harvests, or some other current event in the natural world. But there's a unique migration at our national parks that occurs just about this time every year. It's the influx of hundreds of thousands of human beings. Yellowstone National Park is one of the most popular, and spokesperson Cheryl Matthews says the visitors come in all shapes and sizes from across the globe.
Memorial Day kind of kicks off the summer season. Now, May isn't too bad. That's still a month that doesn't have heavy visitation like you would experience during June, July, and August. During July and August especially, you can get around 800,000 in July and about the 750,000 during the month of August.
Most of Yellowstone is located in Wyoming, but it also reaches into Idaho and Montana. With 2.2 million acres, Cheryl Matthews says it's a lot of park with a lot of fun things to do.
We have around 1,200 miles of trails, so there's lots of backcountry. Less than 3% of the park is developed. The rest is wilderness area, so lots of backcountry areas that people can go to. In developed areas, of course, there's lots of areas where they can walk around the boardwalks, look at the thermal features. Wildlife watching is very popular. Hayden Valley here in Yellowstone is a good area to go, as is Lamar Valley. And, you know, there's lots of ranger-led activities. We encourage people to stop at visitor centers when they come into the park and see what kind of activities are going on.
Fishing for cutthroat trout and brown trout is also a popular pastime in the park. In addition, visitors can see bighorn sheep, sandhill cranes, eagles, and wolves. And with such an array of wildlife, Cheryl Matthews says it's important that people remain alert.
We ask people to remember that wildlife are wild. You know, there are rules and regulations about how close you can get to wildlife. 25 yards from wildlife, except for grizzly bears, and that's 100 yards. And a good rule of thumb to keep in mind is if when you approach wildlife, if they move, you're disturbing them. So all wildlife are unpredictable and dangerous. Even small animals pose potential dangers. So don't approach bison or any wildlife. View and photograph them from the safety of your vehicle. And again, if an animal does react to your presence, you're too close. Another thing here in Yellowstone is with the thermal features is we ask people to stay on boardwalks and designated trails. You know, those scalding waters underlie thin, breakable crust, and each year we do have visitors off trail in thermal areas that have been seriously burned.
The biggest danger in the park, though, could be the impact of the human migration and the vehicles we use to migrate with. Not even the backcountry is safe from the air pollution which our migration generates. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a massive newspaper recycling plant will emerge on recycled land in the South Bronx in New York City. We talk green about whales. The International Whaling Commission has just met, and both the whales and the commission that is supposed to protect them are struggling to survive. Author Rick Bass takes us to a mountainside in a classroom where life ends and begins. Stay with us. From reusable glass and plastic containers to tin cans, recycling has become one of the most common ways of helping to clean up the environment. In New York City's South Bronx, though, they're taking recycling to a new level. Efforts are underway to build a massive newspaper recycling plant. As the Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports, the facility will not only save natural resources, but help rejuvenate a community.
Several groups and a paper company joined forces to create the Bronx Community Paper Company, the for-profit organization that will run the plant. But it's been the Natural Resources Defense Council that has been a leader in the $390 million project. And maybe that's the reason why it looks like such an environmentally sound investment. The facility will be constructed at the former Harlem River Rail Yard, which hasn't been used in about 30 years. Besides recycling an abandoned property, the project means trees will be saved because the plant won't be constructed in a rural area. Moreover, it will save trees by recycling newspaper. NRDC officials say even the recycling process itself is environmentally safer.
The bleaching process for manufacturing newsprint at our mill will basically involve 98.5% water and 1.5% hydrogen peroxide. The peroxide in your medicine cabinet is at 3% concentration. The peroxide we'll be using is at 1.5%. A recycling facility like ours, despite its size, will be using a total of 10 or 11 chemicals compared to literally hundreds of hazardous and toxic chemicals that are used by virgin paper mills.
That's Dr. Alan Herskowitz, a senior scientist with the NRDC, who has been a key player in the project. He says most of the paper will come from greater New York City and surrounding areas.
We will be taking as much as we can get from the New York City's Department of Sanitation. They have a contract with another mill for the other half of their waste paper stream. So we can't capture that, but we'll be capturing the other half. That'll constitute about 40% of the input to the mill. The rest will be coming from the New York City environs, Westchester, Long Island, Connecticut, New Jersey, and we will be consuming about 350,000 tons of waste paper to produce 220,000 tons of finished product.
In addition, Herskowitz says the recycling facility will use water from a nearby sewage treatment plant, thereby saving water in the long run. Despite the apparent environmental benefits, the project has had its critics. A group of South Bronx residents complained that construction of the plant would increase the flow of trucks to the area, therefore doing more environmental harm than good. Their case was eventually thrown out of court. But Herskowitz and other project leaders maintain the overall air quality will actually improve. They say there will be fewer trucks bringing paper from places as far away as Canada. Proponents of the plan also say sanitation trucks already pass near this area on a daily basis, so there will not be a significant increase in traffic. Besides the environmental benefits, Dr. Herskowitz says the economic benefits of the facility should help the struggling community.
It is the single poorest census tract, the single poorest zip code in New York City. The average median household income in this particular community is $9,700 for a family of four. The official federal unemployment rate for teenagers exceeds 60%. Most of the households, 51%, are headed by single women with children. The project will produce 400 to 450 permanent jobs in this community, and about 2,500 construction jobs for 2 years.
Dr. Herskowitz says the mill will provide a combination of unskilled, semi-skilled, and highly skilled positions. This could add millions of dollars to a community in need of financial help. Yolanda Rivera agrees. She is chairperson of Banana Kelly Community Improvement Association, a nonprofit community development organization that is also involved with the project. Rivera believes the paper mill will help jumpstart the South Bronx.
Once the plant does go up, it would have created a recycling infrastructure for the city of New York. It would have created a water rate for businesses to that is very preferential to them and actually will act as an incentive for more businesses to come into the South Bronx. And it'll represent perhaps over $1 billion of additional investment in the Bronx that wasn't planning to be there as a result of it. And it's created a process by which such facilities can be located in areas like ours, where there usually isn't a lot of planning and community involvement in the design and approval of the plants that are located there.
Officials hope to conclude the financial details of the project by September and begin construction by early 1999. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're talking about whales and the international efforts to protect them. Specifically, at the end of May, the International Whaling Commission held its 50th annual meeting, and that's the commission that was set up and has been in existence for a half a century to set the ground rules for the hunting and taking of whales. This year, there was talk that the future of the commission itself was in danger, in part because Norway and Japan have wanted to modify the ban and take more whales. Also, Eskimos and native peoples have long argued that restrictions on whale hunting were unfair to them because it's such an integral part of their culture. So ensuring the survival of whales is a whale of a problem. And we'd like to have your comments. You can call us on our comment line at 1-888-49-GREEN. I have two distinguished guests with me today, Dr. Robert Brownell, and he is a member of the U.S. delegation to the International Whaling Commission, and in fact just came back from the meeting. He's also chief of the Marine Mammal Division at the Southwest Fisheries Science Center, and he joins us from California. Also with us is Jeanette Hemley. She's director of international wildlife policy at the World Wildlife Fund, which is an international organization protecting wildlife. I'd also want to point out that we had hoped to have a representative from the Japanese embassy with us today, but there was a scheduling conflict, and so they could not participate. So before we get into the efforts to of the last meeting of the commission, Dr. Brunel, can you give us kind of a brief snapshot of what the condition of whales are? I realize there are a lot of different kinds, but how do things look out there for the world's whale population?
Well, I think you have to look at it at two different levels. First, you have to look at sort of the species level and then at the population level. And at the species level, most of the large whales are doing fairly well. A number of them were overexploited when whaling was a much bigger operation in the earlier part of this century, but now they're doing better, and most of them that have been studied are now showing signs of increase. But there's still a number of populations, specifically of some bowhead whales and some right whales and some other populations that aren't recovering, and we really don't know why, and that includes the blue whale in the southern hemisphere. And some of these populations only number in the hundreds of whales, and so those are the ones we're most concerned about today.
So, Jeanette Hemley from the World Wildlife Fund, as you look at this, overall, are the existing protections of whales adequate?
Well, that's a big question, because there are a lot of species of whales, and they occur all over the world. And one thing that's unique about whales as a group, and cetaceans in general, is that most of them are highly migratory, and so protecting them requires international cooperation. Whales move, you know, around the world and often migrate thousands of miles into the in and out of the waters of many countries. And so that's why the International Whaling Commission has been an important body to help protect whales. And we are concerned that there isn't enough going on there to protect whales. And we'd like to see that commission move more into a conservation direction. And that's where we have had problems and concerns with the whaling practices, of course, of Norway and Japan, which are undermining what is, you know, in fact, an international moratorium on whaling.
Well, let's look at that for a moment. Dr. Brunel, the Whaling Commission has set ground rules about what can and cannot happen with respect to whaling. Again, in a nutshell, what is the current state of the law on that? What are the ground rules?
Well, the moratorium that Jeanette just mentioned went into, it was agreed to in 1982 and then went into effect in the mid-80s. But under the moratorium or under the convention itself, there's still two old provisions that are used that are sort of causing the, quote, problems today, and that is the ability for any country to have a scientific whaling operation or a research whaling operation, and that's the way Japan is operating now in the Antarctic and in the western North Pacific, taking minke whales. And also in the case of Norway, they're taking minke whales in the northeast Atlantic Ocean, and they're taking them under their objection to the moratorium, which was something that was allowed under the convention when this was first set up 50 years ago. And so they're both accepted practices, but as Jeanette said, a lot of people view this as undermining the moratorium, because the number of whales that have that are being killed now have been increasing, and this year it will be about 1,000 whales that are killed. But if you look back to when the moratorium went into effect in the mid-80s, they were killing about 8,000 whales. So
let me understand this scientific exemption that the Japanese use. My understanding is that recent DNA testing has shown that there is whale meat in various Southeast Asian markets that appears to have come from Japanese harvest. Are they indeed, as far as you know, taking these whales and then selling them, even though they're being taken under a scientific exemption?
Now you're asking something that's even more complicated than what you asked Jeanette. This exemption for the scientific whaling allows the products of the whales to be sold. The only whales that they're taking in the Antarctic and the western North Pacific are minke whales. So those are processed. They get whatever research information they want off them, and they are sold. The problem with the DNA testing about species that are sold in Japan is a slightly different question. The majority of what they find are minke whales from either the North Pacific or from the Southern Hemisphere, but some other species are found, and the question is, what is the origin of those species? Some of this meat was stockpiled in the past, and so the Japanese claim that this is meat that was taken legally back when whaling was permitted. That was probably the case up until recently. Now it's been 10 years since the moratorium's been in effect, or more than 10 years, and this meat doesn't last more than 10 years. And so some of these
might be a little rancid by now.
Well, it does keep, and we have made some matches of some old meat, and so they have good, keep it at a low temperature, and you can save it for a long time.
Well, let's, other than the whales in your home freezer, Jeanette, they say they're taking, 1,000 whales? Is there a legitimate scientific study that needs 1,000 whales a year to keep going?
Well, Japan's taking about 550 whales a year, and the remainder is being taken by Norway under their objection. But the IWC has passed resolution conventions for many years now to say that a lot of, if not most, if not all the research undertaken by Japan can be done by non-lethal means. So we would certainly say, and I think the environmental community as a whole would argue, that there's no need to take the whales for the kind of research Japan is doing. And clearly, as Dr. Brownell points out, there's a commercial incentive to take these whales under this loophole, as we call it, so that they can sell the whale meat for expensive sushi in Japanese markets. I want to just add a little bit to what Dr. Brownell said. One of the concerns we have about Japan, while they may at one level be legally allowed to take these whales because the convention allows it, their own national laws make it very, very difficult to know just what is being sold in their markets. There's this problem with these so-called existing stockpiles. Japan has refused to disclose an inventory on stocks of whales that they claim were legally taken back when whaling was allowed 15 years ago. There is also another source of whale meat into those markets, which is so-called bycatch. Whales are, in fact, sometimes accidentally caught in fishing nets, and then they can sell that meat into the market, so that's leaking into the Japanese market quite legally. And then you have this other source, which is this minke whale catch, which is under the scientific exemption. So we don't know what's going on in the Japanese market, and the Japanese law isn't restrictive enough to get a handle on it. And so that's a big concern.
But I guess what I understand from talking to both of you, though, is that the ban has indeed been somewhat effective in terms of both reducing the catch and presumably helping preserve the populations. The thing I wonder about is, in getting ready for this program, I looked at something that said that the biggest threat to whales now seem to be climate change, chemical pollution, and habitat loss. So is it fair to say that whaling and hunting is not the big issue today?
Well, I would say that certainly whaling is still a big issue today. I mean, I think you're correct to say that the massive whaling of the past is not taking place, and that, you know, that's reflected in the, you know, in what we know of the catch quotas, and the reporting is certainly better than it used to be. But the fact is also that whaling has increased this decade by perhaps by threefold, and we may be on a road to once again large scale commercial whaling, maybe not reaching the levels of before, but. Added to that concern, because of course the threats that you mentioned, I think it's the combined threats that we are concerned about. And commercial whaling, in the point of view of our wildlife fund, is just something that's not necessary today. I mean, it's being conducted by two of the richest countries in the world. It's not serving any conservation purpose or any compelling human need. And when you have the massive abuses of the past in the whaling industry, you know, it can easily get out of control. And in fact, recent reports that Dr. Brownell is can speak to further talks about massive underreporting of catches in past decades by Japan and Russia and some other countries. So
let's look for a moment then at the commission itself. Dr. Brownell, there was speculation prior to this meeting that the whole commission might blow apart because of some of the commercial pressures that were being put on it. Is this body up to the task at this point? What is its future? Does it need to be modified to make it more effective?
Well, I think this is a difficult time for the commission, but I don't think things are as out of control as some people are maybe want them to be or are saying that it may be. So it's just a period of transition, and lots of other things are being discussed and viewed by the commission. The commission is looking at things like whale watching now that, of course, it never did when it was originally set up, because it was originally set up just to regulate whaling. And so it's been sort of evolving over time, and this is always a slow process.
One thing you mentioned was that Norway was operating under an exemption. I take it what you meant there is that if some country says that they don't want to play, they simply don't. Is that a threat to the effectiveness of the commission?
Well, I think that's what Jeanette was getting at earlier, that this whaling under objections to the moratorium is something that was allowed back 50 years ago when this all started, so that if you didn't like the quota, you could simply object to it and go off and take your own quota, and that stayed in place. And so when the moratorium went into effect, a number of countries filed objections, but most of those countries took away the objections in subsequent years, but Norway sort of stuck to it and had research for whaling for a while and then switched the research whaling to what's called commercial whaling. And the numbers have been slowly creeping up.
Very briefly, a comment from both of you in very short remaining time. What can the listener to the Environment Show, who would like to live in a world that continues to have whales, do to help ensure their continued protection and survival? Jeanette?
Well, we certainly need greater support and funding for whale conservation, whale research. We need Congress to provide more allocations of this kind of funding for the big whales. We need to establish more whale sanctuaries through the IWC and nationally. And so those are ways, those are issues I think that the public can engage on directly. And also keep pressuring these countries, either through our own administration or Congress, the countries that are continuing to whale, Japan and Norway, to try to get this issue elevated politically and to get those countries to engage more and comply with the global norms and global agreements that everyone is basically looked to protect the whales.
Dr. Brownell, about 30 seconds. What's your sense
of
what we can do?
I think public involvement sort of sums it up. Things were getting better, and when the Save the Whale movement sort of started in the early 1970s, and there's been some interest lost in it, and maybe we just need to revitalize that interest and let people know that they want the whales to be preserved and not commercially exploited.
Okay, well, thank you both. I'm afraid our time is up. We've been talking about whaling and international efforts to save them. My guests have been Dr. Brownell, who is a member of the U.S. delegation to the International Whaling Commission, and Jeanette Hemley from the World Wildlife Fund. We'd like to hear your views. Give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can hear The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Go to www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. And punch on Listen to the Environment Show. It'll come right back at you. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Rick Bass, it's endings and beginnings in the natural world, from mountains to puddles. In this portrait of place, Bass reads from his latest book titled Where the Sea Used to Be.
By mid-May, the snow was almost all gone. More and more fallen antlers were revealed, strewn up and down the slopes like bones, so that they were easy for the antler hunters to find. They gathered them in great numbers. The mountains were littered also with the skeletons of winter-killed deer, elk, and moose, the bones cast in hopeless disarray. Sometimes there were bones atop bones, from where one deer had died and gone down, and then a few feet of snow had fallen, and then another deer had died in that same spot. It seemed to Wallace that there were enough bones and antlers to build fences, walls, even houses from those white spars. He would spend some afternoons trying to reassemble the bones into working order, as if he were the curator of a great and vast museum. At school, Coulter looked out the window constantly, watching the receding snow caps, seeing them curl over the mountaintops like the sea foam of a retreating tide. Notches, crevices, and passes that had been obscured now became evident. He had picked one particular mountain, Dome Mountain, as his exit route when it came time for him to hike out of the valley, and he carved the outline of it onto his desk so that each day with the tip of his knife blade he could etch into the desktop the contour of that day's shrinking snow line. The contours were pleasing to him, and in his boredom he soothed himself by running his fingers across the grooved cuts in the desk. He was compiling a list, too, of what equipment to take with him on his trip, listing the advantages and disadvantages, the justification of each item. As the afternoons lingered, he would trade notes with the teacher's assistant, Mel, arguing or questioning the merits of each item, until it seemed to Mel that when he left, some part of her, invested in him, would also be leaving. At lunch, Mel took the children down to the river, to the backwater sloughs and beaver ponds, where they caught the tadpoles of spring peepers and Pacific tree frogs and brought them back to the classroom in mayonnaise jars. They placed them on the windowsill in sunlight and fed them flakes of dry oatmeal and watched them through the hand lens daily as the tiny nubs of legs began to sprout and the fatty tissue in their tails shrank. Sometimes in the morning there would be a dead one resting turgid on the bottom, pale belly up, tiny mouth agape, and the students would want to fish it out and give it a burial, but Mel told them to leave it there to disintegrate into a milky blue drifting mass upon which the other tadpoles would sometimes feed. Mel said that as each tadpole died, it released chemicals into the water that had been proven to accelerate the development of the surviving tadpoles. The more that died in that puddle, the faster the survivors accelerated their rate of growth. The students puzzled at the mechanics, the consequences and logistics of such overcrowding. They kept caterpillars, too, in mason jars and fed them prodigious quantities of green leaves and grass and performed crude experiments on their varying rates of growth and development based on different diets. The beautiful myth of the caterpillar spinning its cocoon and disappearing from the world. The leaf litter, stems gnawed bare, and tiny caterpillar droppings an inch deep on the bottom of the jar, and the jar itself, with holes punched in the lid to vent the air, a hothouse, a dynamo of heat as the caterpillar slept. And in both instances, frog and caterpillar, the students marveled at the high cost of metamorphosis. They placed a stone in with the tadpoles for the frogs to climb out on once the transformation was complete, and they hung little twigs and branches for the butterflies to cling to as they dried their wings.
That was author Rick Bass reading from his new book titled Where the Sea Used to Be. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. You can get plutonium at the bazaar on your next trip to India by swapping a tape of this show. Get one by calling 1-888-49-GREEN and ordering show number 441. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.